Now that we're in the thick of an election, everything seems to be all about the horse race. But in the post-9/11, post-Bush era, what kind of America will the next president inherit? And why would anyone even want the job? Matt Taibbi, contributing editor to Rolling Stone, traveled across the country to find out, and the result was his recent book, The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion in the twilight of the American empire. When he was here this past May, we had a great time, so we are playing it for you again today. I began by asking Matt Taibbi why he chose the word derangement to describe his take on the American political system. Was it because he'd been spending so much time with Bill Maher?
Actually, we came up with that before I started doing Bill Maher, but I guess it does fit a little bit. But no, I mean, we were trying to come up with a word that described the phenomenon that I was talking about in the book, which was basically the idea is, and this is always the hardest part for me describing what the book is about.
We'll go into detail, and we still have some time.
Okay, good. Basically the idea is that people have become so disenchanted and disenfranchised with their government, and their government has become so corrupt and so self-interested that they've tuned out from politics, from mainstream politics, and retreated sort of on both sides of the political spectrum into these sort of conspiratorial, paranoid, escapist sort of fantasies. On the right, you have these apocalyptic Christian fantasies about the end of the world, and on the left, you have the 9/11 truth movement. On both sides, these things are becoming increasingly mainstream and increasingly accepted as people tune out the regular mainstream politics.
And you look at those two subcultures along with Congress and the military.
Right.
And the Congress and the military equally examples of deranged
subculture? The Iraq thing we just kind of threw in as a little bit of sort of a scene setter. I mean, I had done some reporting over there. I had some stuff that was left over from my time that I hadn't included in my Rolling Stone articles, and I thought it was kind of just an interesting little vignette that fleshed out the rest of the book a little bit. Most of the stuff that I did, from that part of the world, I was talking about Congress, and I spent an awful lot of time there doing a lot of reporting there.
Are Americans turning away from the whole red state, blue state way of defining their politics?
Yeah, I think it's still relevant, that red state, blue state description, but I think, especially from what I've seen on the campaign trail this year, there's a lot more crossing over than I've ever seen before, and there's also a lot more distrust I think in the past there were a lot of people who are just sort of willingly to blindly accept whatever, say, Rush Limbaugh told them, or there was a liberal orthodoxy that was accepted, where I think in this season there's a lot more willingness to sort of test different kinds of ideologies and find new solutions for themselves on the internet and amongst smaller types of political movements.
Well, you mentioned people who have an ideological view of things in the press, but what about the press in general? Do you think that the public is disenchanted with the way the mainstream media cover politics?
Absolutely, yeah, sure. When I go out there, especially at the beginning of this year, I found this more than perhaps that I find now. But I mean, the mainstream media, the so-called MSM, which you hear is the term you hear used all the time on the internet.
Usually derisively.
Derisively, absolutely derisively. It's they're a villain on par with the Bush administration for a lot of people certainly on the left. And
on the right as well.
On the right as well. They don't usually use the term MSM on the right. They usually use the term liberal media. But it's the same idea.
Well, isn't it amazing that the same people are both too liberal on one side and too conservative on the other, too gullible?
And it's what's funny about that is that they on both sides, I think there's some justification for that point of view, because the whole idea about the liberal media, people, they're looking at the raw numbers of people who actually work as journalists, and I would say that the majority of people who I see in the campaign trail are Democrat-leaning, liberal-leaning. The problem is that the companies they work for aren't. They work, for these gigantic sort of nihilistic corporations that are really only out to make money, and I think they have motivations that one wouldn't traditionally describe as liberal. So, there's some bias that goes on in the media that offends liberals on one side, and there's bias on the other side that goes on that offends people on the right wing. And on both sides, I think they find real reason to be offended.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, whose latest book is The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion in the twilight of the American Empire, published by Spiegel and Grau. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When the Democrats took back Congress, what did you expect to see them do?
Well, you know, I had spent a lot of time covering Congress, especially in 05 and 06. And because I spent a lot of time living overseas, you know, in my 20s, I hadn't spent a lot of time covering it before. So a lot of what I saw in Congress was a real shock to me about how things are run, especially with the corruption with earmarks and that sort of thing. And people were telling me, a lot of the people that I met in the Democratic side, look, things are going to change when we come in. We're going to clean up a lot of these abuses. But it turned out to be not at all the case. In the first year, if you remember, the Democrats came in and they pledged that they were going to do this big earmark reform. They actually passed legislation to clean up that whole side of things. And in the first year that they were in control, the amount of money spent on earmarks went up 30%, and the number of earmarks went from under 3,000 to over 11,000. So, I mean, they've just formally abandoned their idea to impose a ban on earmarks for a year because they don't have the support for it anymore. So,
well, are earmarks the real problem? Chuck Hagel, who is kind of in the center, dismisses that sort of criticism. He says earmarks represent just a spit in the bucket.
That's true.
And his concern and others was rather that there be transparency so that not that the earmarks are necessarily always wrong, he says, mm-hmm. but that we never knew where they came from. And so when there was one that was questionable, we had no idea who to blame.
Well, the earmarks are really just a symbol of a larger problem. I mean, numerically, obviously, it's not a massive amount of money compared to the amount of money that we do spend, that Congress does spend. But it's a symbol of the sort of unchecked spending. I mean, the real problem in Congress is that because it costs so much to run for office, and because these members of Congress have to raise so much money in order to run, they gravitate towards decisions which basically amount to repaying their campaign contributors with public money once they get into office. And sometimes that's done through earmarks, which is the easiest and fastest way to do it. But it's also done through regular old appropriations legislation. It's basically unchecked.
Well, how do suspension bills factor into the legislative process?
Well, suspension bills are bills where there's no formal debate that goes. The debate amount of time is limited on the floor, and it's really only the bills are passed by voice vote. These are really not serious bills. A typical suspension bill would be the renaming of a post office or some kind of congratulatory resolution.
But they take up so much time. And, when people voted this new Congress in, many people voted it in because they were dissatisfied with what was happening. They hoped to see a real change in the way the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were covered or
right.
handled, or maybe even hopes in some cases for people to be that there'll be some withdrawal. And
sure.
There's been practically no impact on what's going on there with this Congress. In fact, there's a sense, and I think the public is very dissatisfied, that not much has gone on at all.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. And the funny thing is that it seems to be a pattern that what happens is the one party is in control of the Congress for a long time, and they build up public dissatisfaction, builds at the corruption that goes on with that party, and then another party sweeps in and repeats exactly the same mistakes and makes it worse, and then it reverts back. I mean, a great example is the number of what we call open rules in Congress, which are bills that we send to the floor that can be freely debated and have amendments attached to them. These are serious bills, and an open rule is really an indication that you have a Congress that's working well in bipartisan fashion when you have a lot of open rules. Well, the number has steadily declined. It went down year after year during the time that the Democrats were in charge during the Reagan years and so on. Then it went down even further in the 90s. And finally, by the last year of Republican rule in 06, it went down to zero. There were no open rules that year. It went back up a little bit last year. I think there were three. But, you know, it's still just a drop in the bucket. So that's a symptom of Congress not really functioning in a bipartisan way anymore.
You seem to be saying that we're lied to a lot by Washington politicians.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean,
who are the biggest liars and what are they lying about?
Well, it's more of a lie of omission, I guess, is the way. I mean, you hear some – the only things you ever hear about Congress are these sort of, widely debated social issues like gay marriage or stem cell research, whereas, I was actually in Congress the day they passed, I think it was the Omnibus Appropriations Bill of 06. So you're talking about 8 out of the 11 appropriations bills for the entire year, a massive amount of money. I mean, something like close to $2 trillion. And I was the only member of the media in the hall that day when it was passed, and there were just a few congressmen there. I mean, so you have this massive amount of money that goes out, and nobody really knows what goes on with this stuff, and they never read. There's never time to read the bills because the way the Rules Committee operates, they have a special rule that they're supposed to impose that gives everybody 3 days to read the bills. But in an emergency, they're allowed to waive it. But that emergency has been in place for like 6 or 7 years now consecutively. So nobody knows what's in these bills.
And do you think the press is letting us down by not going over these bills? As you say, you were the only member of the press at that during that vote. Do you think that this is something that's being done simply because it takes too much work? Is
Absolutely.
It conscious, or is there something unconscious about the spreading of the lies or the ignoring of what's going on?
It's a combination of a lot of things. But, the first story I did about this for Rolling Stone was a piece called Four Amendments and a Funeral a couple of years ago. And a lot of it was I tried to explain sort of the fate of four different amendments that people were trying to pass. One of them was an amendment that Bernie Sanders was introducing that was trying to kill a $5 billion loan to the Westinghouse Corporation to build nuclear power plants in China. Now, Westinghouse is a subsidiary of a British state-funded utility called Nuclear Fuels. So this is exactly an example of the kind of stuff that should never, ever happen under any circumstances. But the time it took just for me to explain what happened with this amendment, I mean, it took me, 2,000 words in the shortest possible amount of time just to explain how this thing got killed. And there's no way that a television journalist can do this kind of stuff. It's beyond their ability format-wise to even address. So.
On the other hand, it's important, and it's my money, and nobody's really telling me that my money is being spent this way.
Yeah, absolutely it's important, especially when you look at what's not being passed, at the same time. I mean, we had a controversy this year about the GI Bill. I'm sure you heard about that. Congress somehow was unable to come up with $2 billion or $3 billion that, it would have been needed to help servicemen in Iraq, subsidize higher education. Well, they sure came up with $5 billion for the Westinghouse Corporation, but we never heard about that. You know what I mean? That's the kind of thing that we never, ever hear about.
But it's weird because we have this 24-hour news machine. And
right.
You would think that within 24 hours, we could at least get some inkling of something other than the same story repeated again and again.
Yeah, I don't have the answer for that. I mean, I don't know who does. I mean, of course, I was there that one day on the appropriations bill, but I was off on the campaign trail the other 500 times. So, I'm as guilty as everybody else. We cover the stories that I think the people believe are going to get ratings or are going to sell newspapers or magazines. And for obviously, Congress is just so labyrinthine, the whole topic. I think it's really hard for the mainstream media to find a way to cover it that's going to be interesting for people.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, whose latest book is The Great Derangement, A Terrifying True Story of War, Politics, and Religion at the Twilight of the American Empire, published by Spiegel and Grau. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Matt Taibbi, who's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, the author of two essay collections, Spanking the Donkey and Smells Like Dead Elephants. His latest book is The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire, published by Spiegel and Grau. So let's get to the religion. I'm still curious about why these four things. Perhaps it was just simply because that's what you were investigating and you put them all together?
Yeah, a little bit of that. Yeah, there was.
But there's no larger overarching theory here.
We sort of developed the larger overarching theory to correspond with the material. Let's put it that way.
Ex post facto.
Yeah.
But one of the things you cover here is the rise of the Christian megachurches.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually chose to join one of them without telling anybody that you were doing this thing undercover?
Yeah. I joined the Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, which serendipitously, I guess, for me, turned out to be. It's the church that is run by Pastor John Hagee, who's become sort of an issue in this year's presidential campaign.
So you did not know at the time that he was going to endorse John McCain?
No, I barely knew about his relationship with John McCain. I knew that they both were involved with AIPAC, which is the Israeli lobby, but that's all I really knew.
Now, do you ever feel guilty about deceiving people about what you're doing as a journalist?
You know, I think if you're going to do this kind of thing, if you're going to do this kind of journalism, you just have to... you can't have too many feelings about that sort of thing. I mean, the job here is to tell the truth and to try to tell people what things are really like out there. And there's going to be some morally ambiguous behavior that goes on, you know, whenever you do these kinds of undercover assignments, you know. But I just try not to think about it. Obviously, I do feel bad about it sometimes. But
well, what did you find after you joined?
Well, I mean, it was I think these churches are. It's a very depressing story for the most part. I mean, I joined this church and I found a lot of people that I was joining with were people who had really serious personal problems. They were really lost, looking for answers in their lives and community, friendship, that kind of thing. They were alone. They were struggling financially.
Well, isn't that why people turn to religion?
Sure. Sometimes, you know. But I think in this case what happens is they join these big churches and... in return for the things that they're looking for, which are, you know, friends and community and some kind of direction about how to live their lives in a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis, they're sort of asked to swallow some political dogma, and they just sort of do it. It's sort of a trade-off that everybody kind of walks into with their eyes wide open, and that's how we end up with, you know, these enormous numbers of people getting, you know, having these political opinions.
And more than politics, you went on a retreat, a weekend retreat, and people were encouraged to speak and pray in tongues.
Yeah, we were. We,
so this is a charismatic church.
It's a charismatic.
Are people not aware of that when they joined?
Yeah, you know, some people were aware of it. A lot of people barely knew what the church was about. They knew that they'd seen Pastor Hagee on television, so they went to his church. I mean, a lot of this behavior has to do with, you know, you have these fluid labor markets, so people move from city to city, and they don't know which church to join. So, you know, it's sort of like moving to a new neighborhood. Do you go to the mom-and-pop hardware store, or do you go to Home Depot? You know, and a lot of these people sort of pick Home Depot because it's the one they see. Then they come in, and they find out about the church long after they've joined it. You know, I think that's something that happens quite often.
How is the retreat designed?
Well, the retreat basically was... It's almost like a Freudian kind of setup where they teach us all to they ask us all to break up into groups and to talk about how we have developed wounds from some kind of childhood trauma. We were supposed to identify some kind of wound that occurred way back in our past, and the idea in the end was we were going to cure this wound by expelling the demon that was causing it. So the idea they taught us that we all had demons inside us, and then we had to replace those demons with our new faith. And so we were taught actually to expel those demons by physically vomiting into bags at the end of the retreat.
It's interesting. It sounds similar to some pop psychology, similar to Scientology, where you
Absolutely.
Try to trace back your demons and then exorcise them.
Right. It could mean with a little few minor alterations here or there. It could have been a Tony Robbins retreat. It could have been a lot of different things. But
and Jesus doesn't play much a part in all of this?
No. You know, there was a lot more of sort of magical hocus pocus that went on than actual, you know, Christian theology. I've gotten a lot of letters from Christians since I published an excerpt of this piece in Rolling Stone. And surprisingly, a lot of them weren't as critical of me as they were of, you know, what you experienced wasn't the true church, and it's really too bad that these people are being manipulated. They're not finding the true Christ, and that sort of thing. And you know, in that sense, I guess I agree with them. You know.
But your suggestion is that there are a lot more churches like this than we would like to believe.
Yeah, no, I've talked to a lot of people who've had very similar experiences. I mean, Pastor Hagee's church is particularly strange. I mean, there are a lot of aspects to it that are far out of the normal.
Well, he's anti-Catholic, for example, to a point where this could come back to haunt John McCain.
Oh, sure, yeah. No, he's had a lot of statements. I guess he compared the Pope to Hitler. They believe that the world is going to end imminently, and this is a prominent part of their whole belief system. We actually had a 3-sermon section last year in church where they outlined specifically what was going to happen at the end of the world and what the various signs from modern politics were that were telling us that these things were happening. And, you know, there are a lot of Southern Baptists or churches that have sort of vaguely this kind of dispensationalist belief. But in this church, it's very, very concrete. They believe it's going to happen real soon.
Well, this is nothing new. In the end of the 19th century, there were many people who believed that we were living in the last days. And some people even named the day and then after that had to deal with it, and some churches fell apart. And throughout my lifetime, I remember reading about churches where they said next Tuesday is the day, and everybody got on a hill or something, and didn't happen.
Sure, yeah, no, that's true. These churches have existed throughout our history, and you know, we have Mary Baker Eddy and all kinds of figures like that in our past. Which is evidence that these things have always been popular in our culture. But the difference is that it's becoming a very mainstream thing now in the South, especially the Left Behind series books, which are about this directly. They've sold 60 million copies. I mean, we're talking about enormous numbers of people that believe this. So, and it's enough people that it's had a significant impact on our secular politics too. I mean, it's been a factor in our Middle East policies for sure, because of the kind of policies that Hagee and other people connected with AIPAC are espousing, supporting Israel at all costs and that sort of thing.
I'm talking with Matt Taibbi, whose latest book is The Great Derangement. Well, there are many reasons for supporting Israel, but the reason for Paul Hagee is because then all the Jews will convert and then Jesus can come back.
Right, yeah. They believe that we have to, the phrase they use is hurry up, God. We have to support Israel, and they believe there's going to be a final battle at Armageddon between the forces of good, which is Israel, and hopefully the United States in conjunction with Israel, and Gog and Magog on the other hand, which they think is probably Russia and Iran in concert, and that there's going to be this massive final battle. And they look at a lot of the things that have happened in the last decade or so with Iraq, the war in Iraq and that sort of thing, as being evidence that we're moving towards that conflict, and we have to get on the right side of Israel in advance of it.
You suggest that there are similarities between church programs like Paul Hagee's and how military companies work. And in what way?
Well, I just, I guess what I was saying there was that, you have, especially the retreat I had was that I went to was led by an ex-military figure, and it was almost entirely a lot of drilling and repetition and that sort of thing, and at the end of it they would just sort of tell us what to think about things, which is very much like what a lot of these kids experience when they're in the military. And I'm not going to suggest that the servicemen are brainwashed, nothing like that, but they have a lot of experience with these kinds of authority figures who, the doctrine in the church, in this kind of church, it's less about a spiritual journey than a journey from weakness to strength. So they always have these sort of strong military types who are the pastors, and I think that's why it'll seem familiar to them if they move from the military to something like this.
But did you find when you spoke to soldiers in Iraq that they went along with everything they were being told?
Largely, I don't think they put a whole lot of thought into what was going on. I mean, I think a lot of the kids that I was with in Iraq, they were really good kids. They were in a highly dangerous situation, and the thing that was paramount to them was being safe and taking care of each other. And I think they had to take it on, as an article of faith, that the mission that they were involved with made sense and was a good thing, because it would have just been too horrible to contemplate having to go through what they were going through if it was completely irrelevant and counterproductive exercise, as somebody like me might believe.
Did you think that the press was doing a good job in covering the war? Or the situation, I guess it's no longer a war. I don't know exactly what it is.
Who knows what it is, right? You know, I mean, one of the things that I tried to talk about in the book was how dangerous the embed system is. You know, you get really attached to the guys that you're with, and you end up writing a lot more about their experience and about them than you do about their mission, because you don't really know a whole lot about the mission. You spend almost all of your time sort of behind the wall on the bases, and you don't have any interaction with Iraq per se. I mean, you're in this sort of American archipelago while you're over there, and the only thing you see in terms of Iraq is, you know, through the window of a moving Humvee for the most part. And so we have to draw these conclusions about what's going on in the war there sort of by looking at a mirror image of it, at, you know, how it affects these soldiers. And it's a very indirect way of covering this kind of thing, and I think it results in a lot of too credulous coverage of the war.
The other subculture you covered here was the 9/11 truth movement. You met the leader of that movement?
Well, they don't really have a leader per se. I met one of the more famous members, this guy Nico Haupt, who's he's sort of famous because he invented the acronyms LIHOP and MIHOP, which stands for Let It Happen on Purpose and Made It Happen on Purpose. He's a German sort of conspiracy theorist.
And they believe that the World Trade Towers could not just come down because of planes crashing into them. Something else had to be done.
Yeah, they believe the one really consistent belief of the 9/11 truth, because it has a lot of different forms, but the one thing that pretty much everybody believes is that the World Trade Center was mined, that there were bombs in the World Trade Center, that they couldn't have come down just by planes crashing into them.
And so that obviously would have been a complicated process. Do they explain how it could have happened without anybody noticing?
Well, one of the things that people talk about is that the security company that was involved with, you know, that was in charge of security at the World Trade Center was a thing called Securicom, which Marvin Bush was on the board of up until a year before the bombing. So by some, you know, twisted logic, they see that as a, you know, the Bush administration having control over the security company there.
So they see what happened on 9/11 with the World Trade Towers as being somehow manipulated so that we would go to war?
The idea basically is that the towers come down, and this provides the political justification for us to launch a whole bunch of wars, you know, overseas, and also in, you know, obviously enhance, you know, the Patriot Act and all these other things that happened in the wake of 9/11 were things that that was the end game here.
Now, you got a lot of negative reaction when you called them nut jobs in an article you wrote in Rolling Stone. Why do you think there are so many? Do you think it's because is that a reflection of American suspicions about how government works in general?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there are a lot of similarities between the 9/11 truth movement and the Christian thing on the other side, first of all, because they both believe in these sort of essentially unprovable theses. You know, in the 9/11 truth movement, they always say, when I ask them to show me the evidence, they say, well, we don't have the evidence. The evidence is locked away in the Pentagon or whatever. So it's something that they can always believe in. And I think the attraction here is that somebody's in control. You know, it's a fantasy whereby there isn't this horrible sort of anarchic, you know, Hobbesian state of nature where, you know, the reality of our government where everybody's just sort of grabbing things for themselves and it's sort of chaotic. Where in their fantasy, it's this super competent government that's capable of these evil conspiracies. And in a weird kind of way, I think that's more comforting than the reality of the situation.
Like a whole bunch of movies in the 70s and where the CIA was ultimately behind everything that went wrong. But you can understand people feeling suspicious. After all, the Vietnam War was based on a lie.
Gulf of Tonkin,
The war in Iraq is based on misinformation. There have been various CIA activities around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the press has done a terrible job of standing up to a lot of these lies. And, you know, after 9/11 happens, the president gets up on television and his answer for why this happened is, well, they hate us for our freedom, you know, which is a completely unbelievable explanation for this kind of act. And I think people looked at this and they said, well, this is a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie. You know, how are we supposed to figure out where the truth is? And I think it's inevitable that you're going to get this kind of thing if you have that kind of landscape where it's impossible to sort out who's telling the truth and who isn't.
It also makes it very difficult to decide who your next president is going to be.
Right.
I'm not going to ask you who you're supporting, but I will tell you that Matt Taibbi's book is a lot of fun to read. It's called The Great Derangement, A Terrifying True Story of War, Politics, and Religion at the Twilight of the American Empire, published by Spiegel and Grau. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.